Station number 12503, Reel 2.
Mr. Lang, Reel 2.
We had, it is unfortunate, this sort of anti-ships versus fleet air arm, versus ship by the fleet air arm, because we had extremely good senior officers on the ship's side, and I certainly have very little, if any, complaints about the senior officers in the fleet air arm side.
What kind of duties did the Ark Royal take up and the squadron when you first joined her?
We went out to the Mediterranean to Alexandria to practice night flying. I think we'd come back, the ship had come back from the South Atlantic, and the Courageous, you remember, had been sunk, and they were wondering what to do, actually, with the carriers just then. It was during the Phoney War, and Norway hadn't started. So they thought we must get more flying practice in so that we could operate more efficiently at night. And we set off then and eventually arrived at Alexandria and were disembarked at Decatur, an airport, service airfield, with the Egyptian Air Force in possession, but you know, we were their guests virtually, and just did ordinary shore-based flying, with a lot of night flying, mostly for the pilots. We did a few night navigation exercises, and we did a lot of day navigation exercises, and so on for a few weeks. I can't remember how long. And we were given a special treat as being allowed to spend a night ashore in Alex at a very posh hotel. I don't know who was going to pay for our beds, and we all went off sort of full of joys of spring. Unfortunately, three of our pilots thought that another of the team, who had won at cards or something like that, was in a certain cubicle in the gentleman's lavatory, and started shooting butterpats and other missiles over the top of the cubicle, and were somewhat nonplussed when the door opened and an Egyptian pasha emerged, who Duke naturally made a very serious complaint to the British consul in Alexandria, which very soon trickled off to the ship. And we were all summoned back on board, all leave cancelled, were all in disgrace, and a disciplinary inquiry started. And that disciplinary inquiry continued, because very shortly afterwards, the Norwegian emergency came about, and we had to go back to home waters as quickly as possible. And it is very difficult to get the time, all the people together, for the investigation, disciplinary inquiry to take place. And I know that one of the alleged culprits borrowed some of my flying clothing, and I never saw that flying clothing again, because the poor chap was shot down later. In fact, all the, except one, all the alleged offenders were lost during the Norwegian campaign.
And then what do you remember happening?
Well, I can't remember what happened between leaving Alexandria, except we went full speed, the two old destroyers escorting us, and arrived eventually off the Norwegian coast, where we just sort of provided such fighter protection as we could do with these skewer aircraft, which are really dive bombers, and patrols and such like over the Norwegian coast. And we personally did the odd bombing on targets which might be of assistance to the Germans and such like.
Can you remember the first time that you actually went into action?
The first time I was fired on, I'm very sorry to say, was by the HMS Curlew.
How did that come about?
Well, the usual way was we made a landfall at the tip of the Lofoten Islands, and then flew into the Narvik area. And off one of the fjords at the entrance to the sort of Narvik area was the Curlew, which is an anti-aircraft cruiser. And I got my Aldous light out and flashed the letter of the day, which was a sort of password. But no regard. Woof! Woof! I don't know whether they were just sort of doing ranging shots, but you would have thought a swordfish was pretty obvious, wouldn't you? And that happened every time I went in. However, the marksmanship wasn't very good, so it wasn't really a cause of much concern. But the only time I was actually directly under fire, we were sent in to bomb the railway line from Narvik across the Sweden frontier. The weather wasn't awfully good, but nevertheless, a railway running on the steep bank of a mountain is extremely hard to hit, because you've only got to miss by a very small amount in the lateral way, and you actually miss by a very long way when the bomb falls down the mountainside. I don't think we hit it at all.
Did you run into the German Air Force?
I personally didn't, no. Except once, I was on the flight deck, doing a turn of duty as flight deck officer. The flight deck officer wasn't a sophisticated appointment, it later became. And my job as a junior lieutenant was just more or less to see the orders of the commander flying were carried out regarding the parking of the aircraft and the signaling of the aircraft to move forward when their hooks were detached. And I was standing on the flight deck with my red and green flags, and I saw this Heinkel suddenly appear out of the clouds. And then, woof, as his bombs dropped in the wake of stern.
Can you say something about the coordination between the pilot and the observer in a swordfish?
But, yes, you had a tube known as a Gosport tube, which is a bit of aluminium wound round in a sort of cylindrical fashion. It was about the size of a small vacuum cleaner tube, you know, that you clean behind the cupboards and things there, probably about 3/4 of an inch in diameter. And it was really very good, but of course you had to hold the voice pipe in up to your mouth and plug in your earphones, which are two little tubes that came from into the reception end. And if the pilot wasn't behaving himself, you just held your voice pipe into the slipstream, which made a hell of a noise in his eardrums, and he soon did what you were told, what you told him. But generally speaking, pilots and observers got on incredibly well. You know, you were very great personal friends. After Peter Compson was separated, I flew with Lieutenant David Godfrey Fawcett, who became godfather to our firstborn, who's now Rear Admiral. Unfortunately, he was lost in a flying accident about 2 years later. Anything wrong with him was that he had absolutely no nerve, and he wouldn't insist on dropping his bombs. All bombs were released by the pilot from Swordfish at that stage of the war. Instead of dropping 6 bombs all in a row, so that you had one chance in 6 of scoring a hit, he was so belligerent, he insisted on going round 6 times the target. This has been our later operations against land targets.
Any other memories from the Norway campaign?
Yes. I nearly forgot to tell you about the watching the Glorious embarking the Hurricanes. You know, that were embarked from the Egyptian airfield. We watched these, can't remember quite how many of them were. They'd never done a deck landing before, and probably hadn't even seen an aircraft carrier before. And there they made perfect landings. We all sort of virtually clapped when we saw them touching on, touching down. It really was a magnificent show. And I think the fact that should have ended in such a tragic, in such tragic circumstances is a very great shame.
I think that squadron was commanded by the gentleman who is now our Chief Marshal Cross.
That's right, yes. There was a lot of, you probably read the book about the Glorious, have you? There was a lot of trouble on board.
No, but I've interviewed some of the
but
people.
But we only, of course, as junior lieutenants, we didn't really hear much about it, except people sort of, when we met Glorious officers, saying that they weren't very happy. It's unfortunate these things should happen.
Anything else to be said about Norway before we leave it?
I think that's all I can think about.
then you went back to the Mediterranean, did you?
Well, we went back to Greenock. Greenock was our sort of turnaround base. And we went to the Mediterranean. Yes, I can't remember. Yes, I think we sailed with, can't remember which flagship, but anyhow, to go to Jib, and I think the Iran operation took place very soon after we arrived. That was, you know, the miserable action at Mez El Kabir.
Did you take part in that?
Not directly on the first, on the day of the bombardment, except to be an interested spectator. I remember you couldn't, the visibility wasn't good enough to actually see the shore, but I remember hearing the almighty explosion and the flash in the sky as the Britannia blew up. And we then withdrew. Some of my friends flew off to attack the Dunkirk, was it, no, not the Dunkirk, the Strasbourg, which was escaping. And there's where you felt the lack of speed of Swordfish, which probably maximum speed of the torpedo about 87, and the ship doing over 30. You didn't have much speed in hand to gain bearing, and they missed, of course. And we withdrew from the Oran area and came back a few days later, I think, to put the crew de grace to the Dunkirk, which was reported to be damaged.
Did you do that personally?
Three of us took off. There were just three Swordfish in bright sunlight to attack a hornet's nest of bloody-minded Frenchmen. And we came in. We were attacked by De Wattin fighters as we approached. I was going to say luckily, but I think by chance. They went for the third in the line. It was I can't remember his pilot. But I remember watching him being hotted up by these De Wattins, and they hit his gunner's Lewis gun and bent it double and filled his aeroplane with bullet holes. And you could see his wings sag as the flying wires were shot away. However, we all proceeded, and our particular torpedo, I watched it drop in the water as the approaches to, or just after we crossed the breakwater. And I believe the history books say that we hit the Dunkirk. But I personally think we hit a tug, because I could see this tug coming out there. And the next thing, the tug was in the air, disintegrating.
It just got in the way.
Just got in the way. Now, whether it was somebody else's torpedo, but, you know, what the allocation of torpedo hits was, I never really knew. And just after that, there was a shell burst underneath our, and we must have been at a bit of height, and I was catapulted out of the back seat. We used to sit on a little stool in this cockpit, because a lot of your work as an observer you did standing up, looking over the fuselage there, and leaning on the partition between you and the pilot. You know, you could see better with the dropping of the torpedo and everything else that you had to see, to fill in your intelligence report. And this shell burst was under the stern, and the Swordfish did that. And I shot out, Now, a few weeks earlier, there'd been an incident when a lieutenant whose name I know, and I remember what he looked like, had been lost through being shot out of the back seat. And we were warned to hook our, what we call G-strings on. They were a little string from the bottom of the aeroplane which hooked onto the bottom of your harness, a sort of clip hook like that. And I, after that, after I'd heard of this disaster, I was always very careful to hook my G-string on. And there I was, sort of leg all askew in the air, my air gunner touching me like a long lost brother, bringing me into back into the cockpit. I must say, it's a very terrifying experience seeing you floating above your own aeroplane.
What time of day did you go in for the Dunkirk? Was it at night or during
the day? Oh, no, broad daylight, yeah. Maximum visibility.
What did the ship look like?
Oh, I think French ships look absolutely first class. And their anti-aircraft, the French Navy, was terrific. It's terrifying because it was they used all sort of coloured bursts. I don't suppose it's any better than anybody else's, but it had a demoralising effect. And you didn't like, of course, doing this operation.
Because of attacking an XLI.
An XLI, yes. So.
Did you see the explosions actually as the Dunkirk was hit?
Well, there was so much smoke and everything about it. I didn't. And I, of course, was absolutely fascinated by seeing this tug. You saw a ship there, quite a big ship, you know, a big sort of almost ocean-going tug, sort of disintegrating several feet above the water.
Did the rest of your brother officers share your feelings about the Iran incident?
Yes. Yes, I don't think anybody was very happy. And, of course, it was a very anxious and prolonged sort of prelude to the whole thing, which has been very well written up by various people. And our captain, Holland, who I've spoken about, one of these outstanding captains that the Ark had at the time, who had been French attaché to the French Navy in Paris as his last peacetime appointment, went and did this negotiations with Admiral Jean Soule. And he'd had to deal, he was a very tactful man, with a very angry French admiral, and had actually left harbour in the destroyer that he took passage in, with the French shells, I think, dropping around him. And he, another time, he flew off, he flew back in a swordfish with boots on, you know, floats, and landed on the Ark with floats on. And the noise of these metal on steel, aluminium on steel, was absolutely horrible. And finishing just with a few feet clear of the end of the flight deck.
I think after Mers El-Kabir, you were engaged in attacks on Italy?
Yes, one of the when we were running convoys through to Malta or to the East Mediterranean, we always had a diversion which invariably took the form of an attack on Cagliari, which is the sort of the big town of Sardinia. And the first time we went, there were two squadrons involved, I think, 810 and 820, and the CO of 820, who was a senior officer, was a senior observer. And somehow or other, the navigation must have been a bit out, because instead of arriving sort of in the dark, we arrived in broad daylight over the dark. I think it's quite a successful attack. The Italians sent up French, sent up CR-42, Kent 42s, which are, of course, rather like our old gladiators, which, of course, were very maneuverable One of the great defenses of the Swordfish was that it could outmaneuver any monoplane fighter. And so we were a bit anxious about this. And I remember in making our getaway, we were all separated, made individual escapes from the target area, seeing one of these little brutes about 3,000 feet above us and shouting down to my pilot to get down onto the water because we were camouflaged and we wouldn't be seen, and getting very quickly down onto the deck and scudding away.
What were the targets in Cagliari?
I think mostly airfield. In fact, they were all airfield buildings. I can't remember which particular strike it was, but we scored a direct hit on what looked like an armory or something, because it was an almighty explosion. And one of our colleagues had to land on the airfield during the attack. And we saw him sort of clambering out. I think he was very well treated until he was sent across to the Austrian frontier to go into a Stalag.
So those were day and night attacks on Cagliari?
Yes. I think there were more than one, or more than one, and probably two attacks, three attacks. The night attacks weren't such fun because you had to dive down searchlight beams. When we crossed the coast, we always noticed what looked like a lot of bonfires being started. Now, whether that was a form of air raid warning, because very shortly afterwards, the barrage used to start. However, I don't think their computers, or whatever it was, the predictors that they had, quite allowed for such slow aeroplanes, because as we approached, the barrage went away from us in front, which was very satisfactory.
How close did the Italian fighters come to?
Not really close enough to worry us. I don't think they had any form of fighter control.
And then I think you were in the Dakar business.
Yes.
I think that was September 1940?
I think it was, yes.
Well, it was somewhere around about then anyway, but yes. If you can tell
me... It was early, late 40, I think. Mm-hmm. Yes, late 40.
Can you tell me what your own recollections are?
Confused, because nobody really knew what was happening. We had some Frenchmen on board with these little sort of French moth-like biplanes. And what we were told, in fact, what the plan was, that these chaps would fly ashore and land in the local airfield and say, "Look here, chaps, You join up now, and to go with all will be well. You can help the Allies to throw the Germans out." And, of course, things didn't go that way at all. And a French sloop went in with a French officer who was in civil life a monk. And I think they were shot up, too. We went in early, about that time, throwing leaflets over, red, white, and blue leaflets, and come on, join the Free French. And I think one or two people got shot up then. And then there's all this indecision about whether to land or not. And I don't know quite what we were doing, but a general, I suppose, security patrol over the area of the approaches to Dakar town, just seeing what was going on. And the two battleships, the Resolution and the Barham, were below us, who started firing. And I can remember distinctly seeing a French submarine diving. And the next thing was you could see very clearly the torpedo tracks hitting the Resolution. And also one of the ships, I think it was the Australia cruiser, had its walrus up doing gunnery spotting, and that was shot down by a French fighter, and the chaps bailed out and most unfortunately landed in the precise spot where some shells from the, one of the French ships or the shore batteries landed. So they, you know, were jolly unlucky.
Did you see the torpedo strike home on the resolution?
Yes, yes.
What did that look like?
Well, just a tremendous puff of smoke. And then poor old Rezzo starting to do...
Heel over.
And she got at about an angle. I don't know what it was. And about that time, we had an unwelcome encounter with a French fighter. I think it was a Curtiss Hawk. They weren't the most modern, but of course they were considerably faster than we were. They probably lacked our immediate ability to maneuver. And we went in a very, very tight spin and dive. But I could see this chap coming up on our tail. And that's when you really say, oh, Lord, please make him miss. Well, he didn't miss. It was a flash of guns. I think he only had two guns. You could see the yellow flash like that from each wingtip. And then his guns jammed. Anyhow, he didn't fire again. One bullet went through, went actually between my legs into our engine. I had a scar just behind the knee, which drew blood. I was terribly proud of this. And I thought I'd get a sort of special mention. The PMO gave me an anti-tetanus injection and a bit of sticking plaster, and that was that. And the bullet went into the engine, but a Pegasus engine went on forever, you know. However, we did come back to base, saying that there was a risk of engine failure.
Was any damage done to the Vichy fighter?
I don't know. Anyhow, he shoved off. My gunner was Petty Officer Airman Ellis, who was a most charming chap, very competent. I shouldn't be at all surprised if he didn't get a bullet or two. But there is a single gun going pop, 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 pop. Really isn't an awful lot of use.
Anything else happened in the Dakar raid?
Nothing more that I can really remember, except the thing was, well, there was a long period of indecision. Was it on or off, on or off, on or off? And eventually it was called off. We were losing an awful lot of aircraft, not so many lives. But I think we lost something like 15. This is purely my impression at the time. Lost one or two people were killed, and I think my aircraft was ranged. We were to go and do something, I think, possibly to bomb the Richelieu. You might as well throw paper balls at a battleship like that with sort of 250-pound bombs. The torpedo is a different thing. And then we went, we had a flat tire or something like that, and the reserve aircraft took our place. And he was actually shot down, and the crew survived. But they did umpteen years in Timbuktu as Vichy French prisoners of war. And they weren't too pleased about it.
Now, you've written here that after Dakar, you bombed a Vichy submarine.
Yes, when the fleet was...